Now for agribusiness news, markets, and weather from Studio C, this is Agriculture Today.
It does look like we will see a return of some rather hot conditions in early July, focused across the Great Plains, the southwestern Corn Belt, and parts of the southeast, not unlike what we have seen for the better part of June. At the same time, cooler than normal conditions expected in the Pacific Coast states, the Great Basin, and the northeastern United States. So we have that hot air squeezed in between a couple of cool air masses on the corners of the country.
That's USDA meteorologist Brad Rippey.
Precipitation, though, expected to be near to above normal in many areas of the country. So hoping that we can keep the showers going despite the heat. There are some exceptions, though. We expect drier than normal conditions in parts of the south central United States. That'll include much of Texas. Also drier than normal conditions in the Great Basin and Intermountain West.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
One of the things that we really appreciate about the way ERP was authorized is there are a lot of eligible weather events listed in that statute and a lot of flexibility afforded to the department in defining those.
Zach Ducheneau is the administrator of USDA's Farm Service Agency.
So there's quite a laundry list in addition to drought. We've got blizzard, extreme wind, hail, smoke damage from fires. The list is pretty extensive, and it's available on our farmers.gov website. And we anticipate that in this first phase, Tony, we're going to get about $6 billion of that $10 billion out the door to producers with not a lot of interaction on their part and not a lot of work on the part of our local staff.
Now, Cody Besant is CEO of Plains Cotton Growers.
It's been fully implemented. The completion or sign-up deadline for phase one is July the 22nd. Most folks should have received a pre-populated form for their 2020 or 21 crop year, depending on if they qualified for an eligible loss. Some may receive a form at a later date throughout August, depending on their type of crop insurance that they took in 2021. By example, if they took Stax or if they took SEO in 2021, we are still waiting on some indemnity numbers throughout the U.S. to finish populating those forms. And so kind of hang tight for the resolve of that. On that, there's a few technical corrections that are going on. Obviously, with any program that's being implemented on a nationwide scale, there's going to be some difficulties on a local level or a farm gate level. And so there are some challenges we're trying to work through, be it one is a means test where folks are looking at 75% of a generated income of farming or more. Certainly that's a case that comes into a concern or an issue that we have been made aware of, where those that have generated that type of income and can prove that up are still being kind of quayed and questioned a little bit on that, largely through some tax provisions that have not been readily updated by FSA compared to what was passed in 2018 by the Tax Cuts and Jobs Reform Bill in the previous administration. So we're still working a little bit in that. Secondly, once phase one is fully implemented and completed, and some of the technical corrections are done, we will venture into phase two. Phase two will be a component of producers that had quality loss adjustments or shallow loss, or producers in the case that they potentially did not have insurance. A lot of that would be on a specialty crop producer within the region or without the U.S. And so that will come before probably November is what we're being told. We don't have a whole lot of details on it yet of how phase two would look like or how it would work, other than more than likely will be a self-certified based program, just because the dynamics of doing a pre-populated form are not as simple in phase two as it has been in phase one. But ultimately, FSA should be able to readily implement phase two just as they have done phase one, as well as producers working in conjunction with their crop insurance agents to correct any technical difficulties they may have had or any tweaks or changes that need to be made from an eligibility standpoint should be able to readily be remedied in phase two. So for those that are having some difficulties, I certainly would encourage them to contact us or contact the National Cotton Council or other appropriate commodity groups to notify of the difficulties they may be having if they are. If not, perfect. The program is being implemented as designed, but we want to make sure we amend or correct any challenges that folks may be having if they are before we get into phase two.
It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
My name is Scott Marlowe, and since January of this year, I've had the honor of serving as the Deputy Administrator for Farm Programs at the USDA's Farm Service Agency. In this capacity, I oversee the management of FSA's disaster assistance, conservation, safety net, and price support programs, including the focus of today's hearing, our dairy programs.
He was testifying recently before the House Ag Committee on dairy policy.
At FSA, our staff have worked tirelessly to find flexibilities in our existing dairy programs to be more responsive to the realities of dairy farming today. And we've made key improvements to both our dairy margin coverage program and our dairy indemnity payment program and to meet the needs of our producers. I'll let Deputy Administrator Cole delve into the details of the AMS Pandemic Market Volatility Assistance Program, the Dairy Donation Program, the Dairy Business Innovation Initiatives, but I'll reference those programs as additional clear examples of this administration's commitment to filling gaps and helping the dairy industry recover and rebuild with resilience. As we look ahead to the upcoming Farm Bill process and opportunities to update and improve our programs, I look forward to providing technical assistance and working together to continue finding the best path forward to support American dairy producers. In the remainder of my testimony, I'll provide additional details on FSA's key dairy programs and improvements that we've made. The Dairy Margin Coverage Program is a voluntary risk management program established in the 2018 Farm Bill that offers reasonably priced risk protection to dairy producers when the difference between the all milk price and the average cost of feed falls below a certain level selected by the producer. In 2021, DMC payments triggered for 11 months for a total of $1.2 billion paid to producers who enrolled in DMC for the 2021 program year. Ahead of the 2022 DMC sign-up, FSA made key improvements to DMC. Specifically, FSA rolled out supplemental DMC, allowing dairy producers to better protect their operations by enrolling supplemental production and providing an additional $450 million in benefits. FSA also updated the DMC and supplemental DMC formula to better reflect the actual cost dairy farmers pay for high-quality alfalfa hay, now calculating those payments using 100% premium alfalfa hay rather than 50%. This change is retroactive to January 2020 and provided additional payments of $42.8 million for 2020 and 2021. In addition to DMC, FSA administers the Dairy Indemnity Payment Program, which has historically provided indemnities to dairy producers for contaminated milk and milk products. And in December of 2021, FSA updated its DIP regulations to better address the tragic crisis of PFAS contamination. Specifically, dairy producers are now eligible to receive payments for the loss of contaminated dairy cows. While I know that our updates to DIP will provide critical assistance to impacted dairy operations, I also want to take a moment to recognize the reality that DIP does not capture the scope of the problem when it comes to PFAS contamination on agricultural lands. Moreover, while New Mexico and Maine have been at the forefront of this crisis, PFAS contamination extends far beyond these states. Unfortunately, the resources FSA has at the ready are not designed to comprehensively respond to these concerns. And as we look ahead to the upcoming Farm Bill, USDA will continue to provide technical assistance in response to any requests from Congress, and we are eager to engage on questions that will help USDA better support the range of agricultural producers grappling with chemical contaminants, including PFAS. I also want to highlight forthcoming disaster assistance for dairy producers. On September 30, 2021, President Biden signed into law the Extending Government Funding and Delivering Emergency Assistance Act, which includes $10 billion in assistance to agricultural producers impacted by natural disasters in 2020 and 2021.
It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
We had a record number of cattle on feed.
Caitlin McCulloch is the director of the Livestock Marketing Information Center in Denver.
And that's surprising and probably a little worrisome when you think about what is fed cattle price going to do, because that means it's higher than what we were when we were backing up cattle in 2020. It's higher than we were in 2021. Now, the thing I was looking at was, what are the weight placement categories telling me? Are there a lot of lightweight cattle? Are we seeing a lot of drought stress? We also heard a lot of rumors about wheat grazing cattle moving earlier. So looking at those Texas numbers, does it show those yearling type weights coming off, or did they already move? And so those were the things we were looking at. I will say I thought May Cattle on Feed did kind of confirm that drought stress scenario when the under 600 pound category was 4% higher nationally and the 600 to 699 pound placements was up 6% from last year. Now, all the heavier weights were down relative to a year ago. Now, when we talk about Texas, under 600 pounds increased by 10,000 head, while the other three states that report were about even with a year ago. For the 600 and 699 category, Texas and Nebraska were down about 5,000 head each, with the other states even with a year ago. Now, for Kansas, most of the year we've seen placements above a year ago, and May was kind of an anomaly in that trend. So they were down about 25,000 head. Now, the flip side of that is Texas has largely been below a year ago all year, and they were down again this month as well, down 5,000 head. So I do think we saw a lot of that wheat pasture cattle moved earlier in that March timeframe, when normally we would typically see that come out in May. The other thing I would like to note is the marketing number came out smaller than pre-report estimates were. So marketing is how fast those feedlots are turning those cattle over and sending them to the packer.
She says consumers are just tired and concerned.
I think the consumer is facing some fairly unprecedented pessimism in their lives right now. Consumer Sentiment Index, which is generally just a survey of consumers that ask them how they're feeling. Are they optimistic or pessimistic for the future? And that number for June, or at least the preliminary number for June, was the lowest on record. Back to 1978 is when that series started. And so to me, that's a very shocking number, that we as a society, as a country, are feeling worse than we ever have during the Great Recession, during COVID. And maybe some of it is just fatigue, that we've had so many things happen. And so I think we now have inflation and recession part of everyday normal people conversation, not just economists speaking to each other, mm-hmm. which is, I think, concerning and really weighing on their minds. And it remains to be seen maybe what that means for beef-specific purchases or substitutions at the meat case. In recent weeks, we have seen chicken breast prices come down after 25 weeks of straight week-over-week gain. To have that price even slow down a little bit is something we're watching. Does this mean we've hit the ceiling for that chicken breast price? And then, too, looking at those relationships. So one of the key things happening right now is that these meat cuts, these substitutions, right, for center-of-the-plate proteins aren't necessarily moving together. So chicken breast and chicken leg quarters have moved up faster in retail prices than maybe some of their counterparts. And so relative to chicken, things like ground beef is relatively less expensive than maybe it normally would from a relative standpoint, if that makes sense. There's definitely some bargains out there in terms of pork loins and hams as well. And so it's going to be an interesting summer. But I think, at least from a meat case perspective, consumers have a lot going on in their mind. And I wouldn't be surprised if we're already seeing some swapping of cuts around or buying maybe a little bit differently than what we were even just a year ago.
It's Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
I'm proud to say that the Department of Energy has taken it on ourselves to be able to catalog where the growth in jobs are in the energy space.
Secretary of Energy Jennifer Granholm.
And so we issued it's called the U.S. Energy Employment Report. And in that report, the key findings really was that the energy sector grew. When I say energy sector, I'm talking about fossil fuels as well as clean energy, right? Grew by 4%, which outpaced the overall U.S. employment, which was about 2.8% in that period. And so that means that, you know, we, first of all, as a nation, we've got to become energy secure so that we're not relying upon the volatility of fossil fuels coming from Russia or anywhere else, right? And we know that our allies across the world are feeling the same way. And part of the way we insulate ourselves from that is to build out on the clean energy side. And so the clean energy sector created huge opportunities in, for example, electric vehicle jobs. Those jobs increased by 26%, added 21,000 jobs across the country. Same thing, solar added 17,000 jobs across the country. You know, there's jobs in energy efficiency that added 57,000 jobs across the country. So bottom line is, super exciting, 300,000 jobs added last year, growing faster than the rest of the economic sectors, and we expect that will only continue in this year.
On the transportation side, the goal is for 50% of new vehicles sold in 2030 to be electric, 100% zero emission vehicles by 2035. It's not the only place, though. She talks about other renewables.
Nevada and Arizona and Texas are just such huge producers of solar and wind. I mean, Texas is number one and number two, right, in wind and solar. But Nevada and Arizona have massive opportunity and can probably learn a bit from Texas and how easy they've made it to be able to produce wind and solar. There's a lot of public lands in Nevada. There's a lot of public lands in Arizona and New Mexico, too. And so the opportunity to be able to generate basically very low-cost electricity on public lands is one of the things that we were talking about when we went there.
But it's hard to look too far down the road without dealing with what's on our plate today.
Yeah, I mean, here's the problem, Tony. As you and certainly your audience is aware, oil is traded on a global market. And when Russia invaded Ukraine, and Russia was such a massive exporter of oil, of Russian oil, and countries sanctioned Russia, like the U.S., saying we are not going to buy Russian oil, and therefore all of the barrels that would have gone to countries, particularly Western countries, came off the market. So that meant we have to increase production to be able to make up for those lost Russian barrels. And so we've asked our domestic oil and gas producers to do that. But here's another problem, not just the supply of oil, but it's the ability to refine it. And so during the pandemic, the U.S. alone lost six refineries. Meaning six refineries came offline. And so we were meeting with the refiners. That too is a global problem, by the way. Refiners across the world closed down their capacity. And so we were asking the refiners, can you increase capacity? How can we work together to make sure we get additional supply for gasoline at the pump so that we can bring down these prices?
Secretary of Energy, Jennifer Granholm. It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
I am Dana Cole, Deputy Administrator of AMS Dairy Programs.
Cole testifying recently before the House Ag Committee, a dairy hearing looking at the future of the Farm Bill.
At USDA, we are committed to being a strong partner for dairy farmers, providing vital market information and programs to spur the development of more and better markets for America's dairy farmers, both here and abroad. While my written testimony provides more detail on the wide range of activities conducted by AMS, I would like to briefly highlight some of our current activities that help our nation's dairy farmers. The 2018 Farm Bill directed USDA to develop a program to reduce food waste and provide nutrition assistance to low-income individuals. The Milk Donation Reimbursement Program was established in 2019. Under the program, eligible dairy organizations may apply for and receive limited reimbursements to cover donations of fluid milk products. Congress authorized $9 million for the program in fiscal year 2019 and $5 million per fiscal year thereafter. In the Consolidated Appropriations Act of 2021, Congress expanded USDA's authority to reimburse processors for donated dairy products and provide additional resources for the new dairy donation program. An interim final rule implementing this program was published on September 1st, 2021. To lessen the burden on participating entities and gain administrative efficiencies, the programs are administered jointly while still maintaining separate funds from which payments are made according to the separate program rules. The 2018 Farm Bill also authorized the establishment of at least three dairy business innovation initiatives, which was expanded to four in 2021 to support dairy businesses in the development, production, marketing, and distribution of dairy products. The DBI initiatives provide technical assistance to dairy businesses and provide subawards to dairy businesses as well. The DBI initiatives approach of providing both technical assistance and subaward serves as a unique and very effective model. In order to improve regional dairy supply chain resiliency, support processing capacity expansion, and increase technical assistance service to local and regional dairy businesses, USDA invested just this week an additional $80 million in DBI funding from the American Rescue Plan. The four DBI partners are now able to reach dairy producers and processors in nearly 40 states. The Pandemic Market Volatility Assistance Program, was authorized and funded under the CARES Act of 2021 and provided much-needed pandemic assistance payments to dairy farmers who received a lower value for their milk due to market abnormalities occurring during the pandemic. Under the program, payments reimburse qualified dairy farmers for 80% of revenue losses for fluid milk sales from July to December of 2020 on an annual production of up to 5 million pounds. USDA distributed the funds to producers through their handlers and implemented a robust oversight system to ensure accurate payments were distributed to producers within the 30 days of a handler receiving the money. A key part of the program was a required producer educational component on the PMVAP program and other dairy topics. Finally, the Origin of Livestock Final Rule was published in the Federal Register on April 5, 2022. This rule provides clear and uniform standards about how and when livestock may be transitioned to organic dairy production and how transitioned animals are managed.
It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
The Cattlemen's Beef Board, which runs the checkoff, typically does a ROI study. And the most recent study, which was conducted by a researcher at Cornell University, showed that for every checkoff dollar spent, the return was in excess of $11.
Talking about the ROI, or return on investment, of the beef checkoff. Colin Woodall, CEO, National Cattlemen's Beef Association.
That's a pretty good return. I think everybody, especially today, given the economic situation we're dealing with, would love to see that. But we can even take that down to a much more specific focus on a lot of the work that NCBA does as a contractor to the checkoff, which is a key thing to remember, that NCBA is not the checkoff. We are a contractor. In fact, we are one of nine national contractors that do work on behalf of the checkoff. And one of the things that we're capitalizing on right now is the fact that many Americans are purchasing their beef online through e-commerce, whether that's through Sam's Club, their local grocery store, Walmart, whatever it may be. And we have found that the return on those programs has been outstanding. In fact, there was one recent program that for every dollar that we spent on advertising, the return on that ad spend was over $30 in beef being sold. So we can show quite clearly that the beef checkoff is returning good things to the industry.
But how is NCBA's policy determined?
The best thing about NCBA is this association belongs to the producer members, not to those of us who work as staff. So we have a very grassroots-focused policy process that sets the policy for this association. And it happens by members attending either our annual convention, the summer business meeting, or both. This is where our committees, which are made up of members of NCBA and cattle producers, that discuss the issues, debate the issues, and ultimately take a position on where NCBA is going to be. Every NCBA member ultimately gets the chance to vote on those policy positions. And only after that happens do we then take our policy book and all the positions that we have taken and go to Capitol Hill, we go to USDA, we go to the White House, and then we then fight for those policy priorities. And that's what gives NCBA its influence, its power, because it's not my opinion that is driving the discussion. It's the opinion and the position of NCBA's members.
So what are the top concerns for producers moving forward?
You know, one of the top priorities is overregulation of our industry. And one in particular that we will spend a lot of time talking about at the summer business meeting is the proposal by the Securities and Exchange Commission, the SEC, that wants all publicly traded companies to report their greenhouse gas emissions. And there is a scenario out there where those of us who sell cattle into the beef supply chain, where they're either processed, sold, retailed by a publicly traded company, would have to report our greenhouse gas emissions on our farms and ranches to the SEC and to those companies. We don't have the technology to do that today. That does not exist. So we would have to provide estimates, and estimates very well could be wrong. and could lead to lawsuits that we then suffer from as producers. This could be a game changer for us in the industry. That's going to be a hot topic, along with the return of Waters of the United States and our continued effort on transparency within cattle markets. Those will be some of the hot topics that we discuss during our meeting at the end of July in Reno.
It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
The beef in cold storage is broken into only two categories, boneless and beef cuts. And so we don't have a ton of data. We can't break it out whether it's imports versus domestic product or what those cuts are. Generally speaking, this report would have been considered bearish to prices. Boneless beef was 22% higher, while beef cuts were 54% higher. And normally you'd be seeing beef stocks decline in summer months.
Director of the Livestock Marketing Information Center, Caitlin McCullough.
So we have a couple things happening, right? We're increasing the number of stocks on hand for beef. You are either looking at that stock number pointing towards we're probably going to see lower prices, or we're going to see some bigger export numbers. It could go either way. Sometimes you see stocks build ahead of that big export volume then being shipped out. It could be a little bit of both. But I think for grilling season for the U.S., it's probably a little worrisome that we're building stocks to that degree.